This program is intended for mature audiences only.
Welcome to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August, and on today's show, I'm very pleased to have Esther Perel. Esther Perel has written an amazing book called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. It's available in 21 languages. It's a bestseller. It's just extraordinary, and it's just my pleasure to have her here. Esther is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and she spent about half of her life treating patients and the other half of her life coaching and consulting and training for organizations and lay and professional audiences. She's a frequently referenced author. Her book, Mating in Captivity, is available, as I said, in 21 languages. It was published in 2006. Her 2002 essay, Erotic Intelligence, Reconciling Sensuality and Domesticity, was featured on the front cover of Utney Reader and was included in the anthology Best Erotic Writings of 2004. She has a private psychotherapy practice in New York.
There is a different kind of intimacy. You know, there's a question I've been asking in the 16 countries that I've traveled this year, and it's remarkable how similar the answers are. When I say desire needs space, desire is built on differences and separateness, it sounds a bit abstract. Mm-hmm. But when I actually ask people, tell me a moment when you find yourself particularly drawn to your partner, I rarely get, if ever, an answer when we're gazing into each other's eyes 10 centimeters for each other and we're melding into one. But we don't all want that uncertainty, at least at home. And at the same time, you don't have to cultivate uncertainty. I think uncertainty is part of love. You know, anytime you love, you live with a certain fear of loss.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
too much fear? No, you can't function. But a little bit of fear is actually essential to desire. And so the moment people start to think about someone else, it gets interpreted as, maybe I don't have enough at home, maybe my partner isn't enough, maybe I'm not enough for him or for her. And we start to experience it as an insecurity rather than knowing that, you know, the other person is alive and well and is responding to all kinds of things.
Welcome, Esther Perel.
Thank you.
I was saying to you before we went on here that I'm just totally taken with your book and want to jump right in and ask you lots of questions about it. So if you don't mind, we'll just dive right in.
Yeah?
I think the place to start in your introduction of the book, you just wrote some words that I thought is the perfect place to start this interview. You wrote, "Is there something inherent in commitment that deadens desire? Can we ever maintain security without succumbing to monotony? The real questions are these. Can we have both love and desire in the same relationship over time? How? What exactly would that kind of relationship be?" Those are the questions. Those are great questions. So can we actually have love and desire in the same relationship?
Yes, I think we can, but it requires us to actually understand that love and desire, they relate, but they also conflict. And herein lies the mystery of eroticism. You see, I think that what struck me was that people would come to my office time and again, loving each other very much, claiming caring, open relationships, and desire was gone, or their sexuality was devoid of eroticism. And time and again, they would emphasize for me the paradoxical relation between domesticity and erotic desire, between our need for security and safety and predictability that brings us to committed relationships, and the fact that eroticism thrives on novelty, mystery, and even risk. You know, if you think about love, you think about having. You think about love is about closing the gap, neutralizing the threat, minimizing the distance. It's that very proximal, no tension that we really seek in the way that we feel accepted by our partner. But on the other end, when you think about desire, you think about wanting. And wanting has an energy to it. It has a drive to it, a striving. And in order to want, there needs to be somebody on the other side of the bridge that you can go and meet and then bring closer to you. And so while love seeks closeness, desire needs space to thrive. And so that's when I began to think, greater intimacy doesn't guarantee good sex. And why is that? Because love flourishes in an atmosphere of mutuality, of reciprocity, of protection. We care about the one we love. We worry about them. We feel responsible for them. And sometimes those are the very emotions that can block the unself-consciousness and the freedom that is needed in desire. And that's why, contrary to what sometimes we expect, growing, flourishing intimacy often leads to decreased desire.
It's very confusing to me. I don't disagree, but it's very confusing to me. Are you saying then that to keep desire alive, we need to lessen the amount of intimacy?
No, but there is a different kind of intimacy. You know, there's a question I've been asking in the 16 countries that I've traveled this year, and it's remarkable how similar the answers are. When I say desire needs space, desire is built on differences and separateness, it sounds a bit abstract. Mm-hmm. But when I actually ask people, tell me a moment when you find yourself particularly drawn to your partner, I rarely get, if ever, an answer when we're gazing into each other's eyes 10 centimeters for each other and we're melding into one. And I don't either get an answer when the other person is so far away that I can no longer distinguish them or see them. It's as if you're holding your finger like 30 centimeters away at a comfortable distance and you look at the other person and the answers are, when I see him playing with the kids, that's a particularly female answer actually. Mm-hmm. When he plays the piano, when I see him surfing, when I see him on stage, when she's giving a talk, when I see how other people are looking at her, when I see him look at another woman the way he used to look at me, when I see him talking and people are charmed by him, when she's passionate, when she's laughing, when she's dancing, it's always when I look at the other person in their separateness, doing something that they are passionate about, that is in their element, and I am looking at them from a distance. I'm certainly not taking care of them because that's a powerful anti-aphrodisiac. And this person who is already so familiar is momentarily, once again, somewhat elusive, somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown. And in that space is the erotic élan. And people understand that desire needs space. It's in their answers. They get it. But when you describe it in conceptual terms, it feels sometimes very abstract.
Yeah.
So when they love, they describe very different kinds of feelings.
Yeah, even the word, I get it, the words themselves get in our way. When do I desire my partner? Well, really what we're asking here is, when do I absolutely feel erotic desire for this person? And that's going to get a little confused. Even just asking the question, when do I desire, it's going to get confused here. You're basically saying eroticism is fueled by seeing the other person as sexy. And so when you're seeing them do something sexy, when you're seeing them out in the world as sexy, you're reminded they're sexy. Is that about right?
Yep. Sexy, smart, interesting, when you have curiosity for them, when you anticipate their return. You know, desire is rooted in absence and in longing. Desire needs anticipation. The difference between sex and eroticism is that animals have sex. We are the only ones that are dotted with an erotic experience. We are the only ones who can make love to somebody in our head for 4 hours and touch no one. Because we can imagine it, because we can anticipate it, because we can experience it even without doing it. And that is the difference. You know, my question was, you know, why is it that people can have the act, but when they complain about the listlessness of their sex lives, most people, sometimes they want more, but they always want better. And what they long to reconnect with is the feeling of renewal, of connection, of playfulness that sex used to afford them. When you talk about eroticism in a relationship, it's about what maintains a sense of aliveness, of vibrancy, of vitality. And sexuality is one avenue to that. It certainly is not the only one. But that's what the mystical meaning of the word erotic is about. In a way, long before modernity assigned to it a strict sexual definition, it kind of narrowed it. And it is a certain tension, you know, that good friends, for example, you know, in friendship, you don't necessarily have that kind of tension, and desire thrives on that kind of tension. When I ask people, when you think of love, what comes to mind? You have words like compassion, acceptance, mutuality, friendship, comfort, warm comes back all the time. And when you ask people, what do you think about when you think about sex, you get words like energy, urgency, hunger, drive, powerful, excited. It's a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
They relate, but they are not the same experience. They actually often spring from different sources. One is our need for security, and the other is our need for adventure. And they pull us in different directions.
So it almost sounds like I need to have two different pairs of glasses when I'm looking at my partner, that there are times when I need to look at my partner through the domestic glasses of, you know, how well we run a house together and how well we raise our kids together and how well we can talk to each other about our problems. But then it's like I need to put on a different pair of glasses to remind myself also to sort of see her new in all her beauty and desirability.
But it's also how you see the other, but it's also how you are seen and who you are bringing, who,
right.
You know, inside yourself you're bringing there. You know, sometimes people say, but mystery, it's like security on the inside and passion and mystery on the outside. And I say, no, sometimes actually mystery is right next to you. It's just sometimes no more than a shift of perception. But if desire is fueled by the unknown, by the unexpected, by the mysterious, that unknown makes us sometimes anxious. And we don't want that kind of anxiety in the same relationship where we seek stability and safety.
Right.
And so we then close ourselves off sometimes to the very erotic vitality that brought the relationship into being. We try to corner ourselves as well as our partner in a kind of fixed, knowable entity where there should not be any surprise. At first, the relationship springs from a surprise. You couldn't plan it. It's chance combined with choice. And you like this unexpected moment, or you would never have met. And then slowly, as you make the relationship more reliable, and as you try to secure love, you sometimes start to ward off the unknown, the unexpected, the very ingredients that create erotic vitality. And
right.
that's the thing that sometimes happens. I don't think security is inherently unerotic, but I think that the way we go about securing our relationships, We end up trading comfort for excitement. We end up trading security for passion. And maybe all we're doing is trading one fantasy for another.
And so maybe there's an advantage to, instead of running towards safety, to sort of run from safety.
You know, I think that passion is commensurate with the amount of uncertainty that we can tolerate.
Mm.
But we don't all want that uncertainty, at least at home. And at the same time, you don't have to cultivate uncertainty. I think uncertainty is part of love. You know, anytime you love, you live with a certain fear of loss.
Oh, yeah.
Too much fear? No, you can't function. But a little bit of fear is actually essential to desire.
This is wonderful. I'm loving this conversation, and talking to you is like uncorking like this, just this stream of great information, and we need to take a short break. So we're going to take a break and give a chance to let our sponsors support us and us support our sponsors. Those of you listening, please do listen to the breaks because there's some good deals for you, and when you support our sponsors, you support this show. This is Chip August, and you're listening to Sex, Love, and Intimacy, and we'll be right back.
Listen to On the Minds of Men, Uncensored Sex Talk with Dr. Lori, a weekly audio program bringing the best in sex therapy to your life on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August. I'm talking to Esther Perel. She's written an amazing book called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. We were just talking a little bit about how safety can kill passion and how there seems to be sort of a dynamic tension between creating sort of this perfect domestic bliss and creating this wild sexual life. And I'm loving what you're saying, and I'm just wondering a little bit about jealousy. You know, it feels like you're opening the doors. You know, it feels like what we do in our relationship is when we finally we've attached onto someone and they've attached onto us is we sort of close the doors to jealousy, and it feels like you're opening them up.
Well, you know, I think that there's a kind of set of paradoxical emotions that actually Jack Maureen talks about, which are often powerful aphrodisiacs. A little bit of guilt can be enormously exciting. A little bit of anger, a little bit of anxiety. When people talk about the excitement of the beginning, they always link it to the insecurity. I didn't know if he was going to call. I didn't know if she was going to come. They understand that the two seem to go hand in hand. They just don't want that insecurity in their stable long-term relationship. I understand that too. But and the same is true for jealousy. Too much of it and you shut down and it's unbearable. Fear cannot become an obsession. But it's also clear that when you think of your partner as this person who you take for granted, who can never leave you, who belongs to you, who's yours, who's given their entire sexual self over to you, you start to flatten the desire in a way, you know, and that's the whole point. Desire needs a certain amount of tension, and that tension comes with the unknown and the unpredictable.
I think also often when we talk about jealousy, we're really there are things that get collapsed in there. I think it's very mammalian to feel possessive of your partner. I just noticed I've had two dogs, and you know they will vie for my attention. I've had two horses in my time, and they will vie for my attention. I don't think that sort of that I want you all to myself thing is a bad thing. I just noticed that in the name of jealousy, we also lump in low self-esteem and wanting to control someone, and those things I think make prison.
Yes, but for me, when I think about jealousy, I think of it in the healthy sense as a natural ingredient of love.
Yeah.
Jealousy, in its best, is the expression that your partner doesn't belong to you. And in that sense, if you want to maintain them and if you want to continue an erotic engagement with them, you have to cultivate it and you have to keep them interested and vice versa. And in that sense, you know that they have a sexual sovereignty, that they are their own person, they are free, and they choose to be with you. You know, the image I often use to explain what does it mean reconciling closeness and freedom, if you want, is when you have little children, and anyone who's ever had a little kid on their lap will have known that experience. The little kid sits there, comfortable, cozy, well-nested, and at some point he jumps off, and she starts to run, and they want to see and discover the world and explore and see what's out there, and they are savoring their freedom and their autonomy. And at one point they turn around, and they look at this adult. And if the adult says, go for it, kiddo, enjoy it, I'm here, you know, go see what else is out there, what does the kid do? Turns around and goes further and is experiencing at the same time the confidence and the trust of the connection that allows them to savor their freedom. But if when they turn around, they see this adult that says, I'm lonely, I'm depressed, I'm worried, how come you're having such a great time and I'm not involved? You know, I'm going to make you feel guilty for that. I'm at a loss. Then the kid has a few options. One of them is that they instantly come back and they sit on your lap and they understand that closeness means compromising your own autonomy, that if you don't want to lose the other, you will lose parts of yourself. And that actually is often the very person who later on will have a harder time making love to the person they love. Because they're not able to maintain that freedom, that separateness that you need in order to experience sexual pleasure.
Yeah.
Or the little kid is zesty and still wants to go on, and then they look over their shoulder all the time. Are you not going to punish me? Are you not going to be gone? Are you not going to abandon me? And that's the person who often is unable later on to experience enough pleasure because they're spending all their time in their partner's head and not enough inside their own body. And are you bored? Am I taking too long? Are you having a good time? Is this good for you? You know, but in a way where they constantly need reassurance. And when you are in reassuring a partner during lovemaking, you enter caretaking mode. And when you are into caretaking mode, you're no longer into the erotic realm.
Right.
You're in love, but you're not in desire.
Right, right. And you may be having sex, but the likelihood is it's not very passionate and it's not the sex you were really aiming for.
No, because in order to have sex that is passionate, where you can combine the best of self-absorption and generosity, where you can at the same time be inside the other person's space or body as well as inside yourself, you need to know that the person that's next to you is strong, is resilient, and that you don't have to take care of them. Otherwise, you can't retreat and go inside yourself. That's really when, you know, when people talk about letting go, you can only let go with someone who you feel is solid and is not going to be too fragile and will be able to resist and welcome even the raw edge of your desire and of your lust. You know, sexuality is powerful.
And so is it our fear then, our fear that the sexuality will somehow be more powerful than our love and so we'll lose love?
No, I think our fear is that, if you know, one of the questions that I often ask, people are very bogged down with statistics these days. You know,
yes.
Do you still have sex? How often? How hard? How long? How many? I tend to shy away from much of these questions because I find that they tell you very little. But what I do ask is, what does sex mean for you?
Mm.
What are the emotional needs? What are the expectations, the yearnings, the desires, the vulnerabilities that you bring into the sexual encounter? Is it rebellion? Is it a spiritual connection? Is it a moment when you can finally not have to feel responsible and somebody can take care of you? Is it a playfulness? Is it vengeance? Is it jealousy? Is it power? Is it surrender? What does sex mean for you?
And can people answer these questions?
Yes, it's really interesting because they've never been asked that question. It's
right.
Actually one of the very interesting conversations partners will often have with each other, you know, where you find that when you actually understand why is that thing important to them, or why is that thing frightening to them, or why is it something that they would rather avoid if they could, you get a good sense of it, because our sexuality and particularly our erotic fantasies probably convey some of our deepest truths, a certain kind of truth about ourselves that words can only gloss over. You know, our mother tongue is our physical language long before we could utter any words. What we say with our body is often, quite separate from what we can talk about. And
yeah.
It's that makes it very vulnerable. In some way, I would say there is no such thing as safe sex. You know, when you actually bring yourself to your partner in such a way, it's vulnerable. What stops people more than stress, more than tired, more than busy, is the fact that it's fearful. It's vulnerable to reveal yourself like that to the person that you depend upon for so much.
Yeah,
you can do it with people you don't care about more easily.
Which is sort of the paradox, though, because, okay, so...
Yes, it's not what you would expect, right?
Well, more than that, though, that I need to have a certain level of genuine intimate connection to feel safe enough to go to that edge.
Yes.
And yet, at the same time, I need not to have that intimate connection get in the way of me going to that edge. So that I want to feel, it is exactly your parallel. I think our sex lives in our child, in the child that lives inside us. I want to know that I'm free to jump off of mommy's lap, but I want to know that the lap will still be there. And if I can find the dynamic balance between those two, maybe then I can have the experience I'm looking for.
Kids play hide and seek.
Yeah.
We do that in sex.
Yeah, exactly.
The adult version of hide and seek is our erotic life.
Exactly.
Exactly that. It's the ability to do both, and we straddle both from the moment that we are born, actually. But when you play with the image of a kid, you understand instantly that they need to be able to experience the trust, the intimacy, the connection, in order to be able to delight in their freedom.
Yeah.
But it's the same for the adults.
Yeah. Now I notice you're a very big advocate of fantasy. In the book, you actually said that you think that fantasy is a valuable imaginative resource. And would you say more about how fantasies play a role in all this?
Yes, but I think that the problem with the word fantasy is that it often conjures up immediate associations to toys and aprons and masks and, you know, characters and plots.
Mm-hmm.
When I use the word fantasy, I really talk about the erotic imagination, because
mm-hmm.
that's what makes desire. Desire is really an imaginative production that takes place in our head. You know, it's what we can imagine, it's what we can anticipate, it's seduction, it's curiosity, it's all of that. And when people have a breakdown in desire, they often actually have a breakdown in the imaginative production, not of the mechanics of sex, not of the positions, but of the ability to imagine themselves differently with that same person over time and to see that person through a different lens. It's that. So what happens? When you have imagination, you can remember what it was like in the past. When you have imagination, you can remember the breast you no longer have. You can imagine yourself suddenly chasing someone with just with your own fantasy as you're sitting at a red light in your car. I mean, it's that meandering, that freedom of the mind that is so essential to keeping our own erotic selves alive. And it's really with oneself first. Most times, it's not necessary to share our erotic fantasies with anybody.
So you're not suggesting, for instance, that the fact that I fantasize about some other person, that I don't, while I'm sitting in my car at a traffic light, I don't need to come home immediately to my wife and say, wow, I just had the most erotic fantasy about so-and-so. You're just suggesting that we need to allow that fantasy life to have full play in our lives.
Yes, because when you know, you can go home and share that with your partner if your partner is into it and if that's part of your erotic plots and narratives, you know, if that's part of your playfulness and they like to hear it and they like to peek in your own red light district, take them there. But if you go home just because you feel that you have transgressed, just because you had a thought, just because you had a temptation, rather than understand that you are allowed to think whatever you want and then you still come home and you bring that aliveness, the fact that you have those thoughts back to your partner, I think that that actually is often very nourishing to the relationship. But you see, there's something in the romantic ideal that told us, if you choose me, then that means, and I chose you and we found each other, we will never need anybody else, because the romantic ideal says there is one person with whom you can have everything, and for 40 years these days.
Yeah.
And so the moment people start to think about someone else, it gets interpreted as, maybe I don't have enough at home, maybe my partner isn't enough, maybe I'm not enough for him or for her, and we start to experience it as an insecurity rather than knowing that, you know, the other person is alive and well and is responding to all kinds of things. And we don't have that insecurity when they have thoughts, other kinds of thoughts. It's particularly about erotic thoughts that we stand to feel, I'm being replaced. I'm no longer the only one. I'm no longer unique. And we live with that fear that that already is a certain form of leaving, rather than knowing that actually the person has that experience and they voluntarily, freely choose to come home, like the little kid who runs back after they've seen enough.
Well, and it's also clear to me that if what we do, if what we practice all the time, all day long, is to turn off our erotic thoughts, turn off our fantasies, turn off that part of our being, it's not, if that's the thing we practice, that's the thing we get good at. And I often think that the death of eroticism in relationship is simply that we've stopped being an erotic being in any part of our life except the bedroom with our partner, and it's very hard to just turn it on like a switch. It doesn't work that way.
Well, people have two other outlets these days to experience a sense of eroticism in the definition that I use, right? This kind of aliveness, this
yep.
vibrancy, this exuberance. Work, and more importantly, children.
Yeah.
Because what you see often today is that with this kind of unprecedented child centrality that we are facing in many Western countries, people will actually often redirect the erotic energies. They will play with the kids, and they'll do the same old with their partner. They'll look for new things with the children. They'll dress the kids
wow.
in the most beautiful fashion, and they will walk around in these old sweatpants. The kids will get the languorous hugs, and the couple will survive on a diet of quick pecks. The erotic energy is often alive and well, but it's eros redirected is what I call it.
Wow. That's fascinating. We have to pause for a break again. I just love talking to you. My name is Chip August. You're listening to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. And please listen to these messages from our sponsor. And don't forget to come right back, because Esther Perel is going to give us an exercise you can do to help the intimacy and love in your own life. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listen to A Taste of Sex, Life in an Orgasm-Based Community, a weekly online audio program where orgasmic innovators share the intricacies of their practice on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August. We're talking to Esther Perel, the author of Mating in Captivity, and we've been talking about desire and sexuality and how to keep desire and sexuality alive in our relationship. I'd love to know, in your book, you have a really nice, you talk very well about monogamy. And so would you say, sort of, what is monogamy to you? What do you mean by that word? And is it okay? Is it dying? Is it all right?
It's a whole chapter. It's called The Shadow of the Third, actually, and then : Rethinking Fidelity. But what I began to try to understand was, originally, when I began to think about the book, it started to incubate during the Clinton affair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very struck by how in the United States, the country was often quite at ease with multiple divorces as a society, but rather intolerant of infidelity.
Exactly.
And the rest of the world actually often seemed to be more tolerant of infidelity and more intransigent toward divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began to think, what is it about monogamy? I mean, monogamy is the sacred cow of the romantic ideal. It is notion that because we chose each other and we were going to be everything for each other, we would forever be faithful. And then it became a matter of total sexual exclusivity. Of course, I think that most people today, certainly in this country, will have two or three relationships in the course of their life, except that some will do it with the same person. We live twice as long, and we're not going to have one relationship, and we're not going to have one sexuality. We're going to have, in the course of our own life, multiple sexualities and multiple relationships, sometimes with the same partner. Monogamy, what happens is that it often is assumed rather than negotiated. And so what happens is many times people will negotiate it privately in their own head. They'll create their own rules. Every couple has boundaries. Even an open relationship has boundaries. There is a sense of a line that is drawn, and if you cross that line, you have betrayed, you have violated the trust, you have gone outside our agreement. So there is no such a thing as a couple without boundaries. Monogamy mm-hmm. delineates that boundary. But today, we do serial monogamy. We go from one person to the next. In the past, it would have been one partner for life. Now it is one partner during the time of that particular relationship. And so I began to rethink fidelity with the help of a lot of the gay couples that I was working with,
mm-hmm.
because they did not necessarily immediately link monogamy with sexual exclusivity. They actually linked it with commitment, with loyalty to a primary relationship, with an emotional engagement, and not necessarily with the sexual component of it. And then from there, I began to think, it's remarkable how many times I see couples who are sexually exclusive, and yet they betray each other in so many other ways.
Yeah.
The primacy of the sexual betrayal, as if that one stands above all others, when people can for years be neglectful of each other, be indifferent, be dismissive, be disqualifying, be rejecting, and all of those forms of betrayal don't seem to get the same kind of resonance. Because what? What is it about sexual betrayal that seems to hit us in a spot that is beyond all others? And I think part of it is because it really touches the fantasy of oneness that we have in the kind of intimate coupling that we are involved with today. Now, I'm not the person who is going to tell people to be or not to be monogamous. And for that matter, nobody needs Perel to cheat. They'll do it on their own. But I wanted to have a possibility of having a critical, thoughtful conversation on the subject of infidelity and of monogamy and of the fact that, contrary to what we often think, infidelity is not always the symptom of a problematic relationship. People stray for a multitude of reasons, and that what's most important is to understand the nature of the infidelity. And more importantly, people sometimes stray while they love their partner dearly and while they are actually quite content in their relationships. But sometimes there's something that suddenly struck them that they didn't even know existed, for that matter. It's not always that they were looking for something. Sometimes it's just the fact that they didn't resist an occurrence of life. And more importantly, And that's been actually, you know, one of the points that has often been asked from me, is that I must say that sometimes I see certain infidelities stabilize the relationship.
Wow.
They make it actually possible for people to stay married to the same person, to maintain their family, to stay close to their children, etc. They don't really want to leave. But sometimes they find that there is something in the relationship that they don't experience. Sometimes their partner is utterly not interested in a sexual connection with them. Sometimes there's a kind of lack of attention and disenfranchisement that has taken place. And so people begin to compartmentalize. And I really don't think I need to be the person to justify it or defend it, but I wanted to make myself available to study it, to understand it, and to be a witness for multitude and countless of couples who would come to me in variations of infidelity.
To be fair, I don't think you are telling people they should be unfaithful or they shouldn't be unfaithful. And if you're a student of history, if anybody's a student of history, just read biographies. Pick your great person and just read biographies. Forever, there have been relationships which stood the test of time and also included sometimes sex outside that relationship. And that it's not really clear to me. It's just, I get that it's, that if there are as many couples as there are, that's how many different relationships there are. And everybody has to really find their own path and find their own way.
But you know, historically, monogamy was basically an imposition from the patriarchy on
women.
It had nothing to do with love.
Yes, but there was Thomas Jefferson clearly having offspring with Sally Hennings, and there was Franklin Roosevelt having an affair with his secretary, and Dwight D. Eisenhower having an affair with, and you know, I mean, pick your error, pick your person, and what you discover is the relationships can be powerful and strong and actually work well together, and also sometimes include sexual activity that happens outside of that relationship, and sometimes sexual activity outside that relationship is actually a cancer that's just the beginning of the end. You can't tell just from the sexual activity.
I think that some infidelities will often finish off a relationship that was already gasping.
I agree.
Sometimes they will create a tear, an emotional tear that is beyond repair, and sometimes they actually become the most invigorating alarm system that a couple could have hoped for, even though that's not what they planned and that's not how they would have wanted to do it, but that's what it did.
I could talk to you forever, and we're starting to run out of time here. If people wanted to get your book or find your website, where would they find you?
All right, the book is Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, and it's actually coming out in paperback in the U.S. this week. They can go to my website, estherperel.com, and it is linked to Amazon. It is to be found in every bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders, etc., and they can order it in all the other languages also through the website and through the local Amazons in each country.
You have been a delight to talk to. Those of you who are listening, if you don't want to write all that down or didn't remember to write all that down, if you just go to www.personallifemedia.com, you can find text and transcripts for all of the Personal Life Media shows, including this one, and in the transcript is a link to Esther Perel's site, so you don't have to remember it. You can just go on our site, and we'll link you right up to her site. Also, if you have feedback for me and you'd like to send it to me, I can be reached at chip@personallifemedia.com, and I'm happy to read your feedback, and I'm always interested in what you have to say. If you feel like you want to leave that feedback verbally rather than in email, we have a voice message machine, a voicemail machine, at 206-350-5333. That's 206-350-5333. Please leave your name, leave the name of my show, Sex, Love, and Intimacy, leave your question or comment, and your phone number and or email address. And just know that when you leave a message on our voicemail system, it indicates to us that we have your agreement for us to potentially use it on air if we would like to. So if you don't want it used on air, please don't leave it there. Before we go, I always like to have my guests give us an exercise, something that can help you at home with your own love, intimacy, and sexuality. And so, Esther, have you got something for people?
Yes, I actually wanted to take the example that I gave during the interview and have you kind of develop it together. And
absolutely.
You take a sheet of paper, you divide it in two, and on the left, you ask yourself, when I think of love, what comes to mind? And you just allow yourself to free associate your own images, associations, metaphors, thoughts. And then after that, when I am loved, I feel. And then below that, when I love, I feel. And on the other side, when I think of sex, what comes to mind? And then after that, when I am wanted, I feel. And then after that, when I want, I feel. And if you want, you can have a fourth category in which you think, and when I think about the love between me and my partner, or when I think about desire between we and my partner, I think of. So that you go from the large to the specific into your own relationship. And then if you want, you just read them out loud to each other, or you read your partners, and you get a sense together. You know, in what way does love and desire intersect for you? Because for some of us, they're inseparable, and for some of us, they are quite disconnected. And what are actually the most powerful feelings that you see drive each of these experiences for you? And what would you like more of? What would you like to experience more with your partner, erotically speaking? Where do you feel yourself most free? And when do you experience your relationship as most erotic? Those are the kinds of questions that I think would give you a very interesting chat, and one that probably is quite different from the way that often couples talk when they talk about their sex lives.
Yeah, I think that could definitely open up some doors between people. I want to thank you very much for being my guest on the show.
It's a pleasure.
And I want to thank you listeners for listening. This brings us to the end of another episode. Please keep listening, and I'll be talking to you again soon.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.